morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanz on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 6, 2021. Former Sudanese judges protest a decision by the transitional government to dismantle institutions linked to ousted President Omar al-Bashir.
This number has negatively affected the routine work of the courts, and as a result, it has also delayed access to justice for many Sudanese.
And members of a South Sudanese opposition group struggle for government positions.
There are two different lists of nominees in the office of the president, one for five signatories, and we nominated deputy governors for Awil, Warab, and Central Equatorial States. And one list only signed by Peter Mayen. We called several joint meetings with Peter Mayen, but he refused to attend all these meetings.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. More than 150 Sudanese judges are protesting a decision by a government committee to dismantle some of the institutions linked to former President Omar al-Bashir. The committee accuses the judges of being supporters of former President Omar al-Bashir. A representative of the fired judges say the government should reinstate them back to their positions. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Speaking to reporters in Khartoum on Tuesday evening, Judge Suleiman Ahmed Muhammad says the dismissal of 151 Sudanese judges was illegal and violates their human and professional rights. Judge Ahmed says the firings include 39 judges from the High Court, 38 from the Court of Appeals, 30 from the General Court, 18 from the First Class, 4 from the Second Class, and 5 from the Third Class judges. He says the dismissed judges represented nearly 14% of the total 1,100 judges nationwide. Ahmed calls the move unfair and illegal.
This number has negatively affected the routine work of the courts, and as a result, it has also delayed access to justice for many Sudanese. The decision has hurt the interests of our people in accessing justice. Lawyers are aware of this, and all the Sudanese people who have been affected as well.
The judges were fired in August 2020 by a special committee tasked with dismantling the previous administration and recovering funds and assets stolen by officials in former President Omar al-Bashir's government. Judge Ahmed says the decision violates the independence of the country's judiciary.
The judiciary now has been totally politicized, and even judges in different courtrooms are afraid to pass a ruling in certain hearings. They fear of falling victims of yet another decision by the 11 judges who sit on the committee and who could target and accuse them of being supporters of the previous regime.
Ahmed says the families of the dismissed judges are now struggling to provide for their children's needs. He also points out that the country invested in training the judges, whom he says have acquired experience that could help the transitional government and the Sudanese people easily access justice.
The dismissal of judges has now become a spear to threaten judges in courtrooms. It has become an atrocity used to threaten our colleagues, which has led to the paralyzing of the judiciary. Cases that could be finalized in a few hearings are now taking long as judges fear of falling victims of this committee.
Ahmed says the decision to sack the judges also violates international human rights laws, and the judges will seek to petition the Constitutional Court. If they fail in that arena, he says, the judges will take to the streets to demand reinstatement. He says their firings discourage foreign investment in a country whose justice system is weak.
We don't expect someone to risk his or her money by coming and investing in Sudan in this confusing situation. They could only come in if they knew the justice system of the country was well established and was able to provide them with justice. So when there is no justice, the investors will not attempt to come to the country.
The panel that fired the judges, formed in October 2019, was mainly tasked with investigating the assets and funds accumulated by members of the previous regime and to review employment documents at various institutions. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Some women rights activists and leaders in Jonglei State are calling on the state government to do more to protect women and girls against sexual and physical abuse. An activist with a board-based advocacy group says some women in Jonglei State are exposed to high risk of sexual abuse and physical violence due to the recurring cattle raids and intercommunal violence in the area. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
30-year-old Nyakwath Charnyang says she and 9 other women went to harvest crop from their farms in Pangonkwe village in Duke County when gunmen abducted them on Saturday. Charnyang, who was shot in the leg, says the abductors threatened to kill the women if they refused to go with the men and become their wives.
The gunmen came and pointed the gun at us. They forced us to go with them and become their wives. One woman resisted and she was stabbed several times with the knife on the AK-47. We ran with them to the bush. I later tried to escape, but they shot me in my legs.
Charnyang says the gunmen beat the women who resisted and they were forced to move along with the group. Acting Duke County Commissioner Elijah Manyok says local youth and security personnel pursued the abductors and rescued all 10 women on Monday.
The 2 women have been injured. One woman, her leg has been broken, and the one has been injured in her stomach. And now they are in the hospital. They're taking treatment now.
Activist Bol Dengbol with the board-based advocacy group Interpit South Sudan says women, especially in Jonglei State, are at increased risk of sexual abuse and physical violence due to recurring cattle raids and intercommunal conflict in the region. Bol urged state lawmakers to do more to protect women from harassment and abuse.
This area is very hungry prone, very hunger, prone, and people are trying to grapple around to see what they can eat, what they can feed their family. In this situation, the humanitarian access is very limited in this very harsh environment. So we condemn this in the strongest terms possible, and also ask the government, the Jonglei state government and the government of the Republic of South Sudan, to look into this, take this seriously and do something about it other than sitting down and do nothing about it.
Bol says state officials should set up increased security in every corner of the state so that women and other citizens can move freely when looking for means of survival. Jonglei State Acting Secretary General Duom Kualagir says state officials held a meeting today in Bor to discuss how to reduce insecurity in Duke and other surrounding areas.
We are just conducting security meeting now. Because of these issues, community, how they should be run, how violence should be prevented. So this is Wednesday. It's a day allotted for security meeting to see what happened in Duke Town and surrounding areas.
According to a report in June 2020 by the Office of the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General on Sexual Violence in Conflict, South Sudan has endured a protracted conflict and instability during which crimes of conflict-related sexual violence have reached appalling levels of brutality, often committed with marked political and ethnic undertones. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
From Bor, we move to Juba, where some senior politicians with a coalition known as Other Political Parties are accusing Peter Mayen, leader of the People's Liberal Party, of blocking recent appointments of 3 deputy state governors. The leader of the National Alliance Party says Mayen disagreed over the list of opposition nominees and illegally submitted a different list of nominees to President Salva Kiir for appointments. For VOA News, Daniel Friday Martin reports from Yei.
Last month, President Salva Kiir Mayardit appointed 6 deputy governors for 6 states nominated by the ruling SPLM party and the SPLAIO in an effort to carry out terms of the peace deal. But leaders within the Coalition of Other Political Parties, or OPP, disagreed with the nominees selected for deputy governor positions and delayed their appointment. Cornelio Kon, who heads the National Alliance Party, a member of other political parties, blames Peter Mayen, the leader of the People's Liberal Party, for causing confusion over the appointment of OPP deputy governor nominees. Cornelio says the OPP is deadlocked over the appointment of its nominees.
There are two different lists of nominees in the office of the president. One for 5 signatories, and we nominated deputy governors for Awil, Warrap and Central Equatorial States, and one list only signed by Peter Mayen. We called several joint meetings with Peter Mayen, but he refused to attend all these meetings. And even the presidential advisor Tutkeo invited us for a meeting, and Mayen refused to attend for 5 times. And why is one person delaying the implementation of the peace agreement?
Albino Akol, Secretary General of the African Congress Party, also blames the leader of the People's Liberal Party for delaying the appointment of OPP nominees for deputy governors.
It is still Peter Mayen and those who believe in him, because you can see now who went and stopped the appointment of 3 deputies nominated. There is no change from what we did, because it is fair enough. We want to follow the agreement. So any decision to be accepted must bear the signatures of the 6 people, or at least majority of them. So we want all these people to go according to the agreement.
Both Cornelio and Albino say OPP infighting over the list of nominees will affect the implementation of the peace agreement.
These allegations is never true. Why should I block the appointment of the deputy governors when I relinquish the governor positions in order for peace? There is no blocking, there is no coalition or anything that's happening. The OPP is a coalition, and therefore the participation of the parties is actually based on their presence and their dominance in those very areas.
Razab Mohandis, a civil society activist and executive director of a local NGO, Organization for Responsive Governance, urges OPP leaders to resolve their differences quickly and move on with implementing the peace deal.
The parties signed the agreement as coalitions. They are all together, parties to the peace agreement, and so none should be excluded. And on that note, they should then agree on how they share these few positions that they have. The percentage allocation is clear, the number of seats of them is clear.
Mohandis says disagreements over positions demonstrates the inability of leaders in the other political parties' coalition to manage the affairs of the country in the future, and reiterated his call to resolve the matter quickly. For VOA News, I am Daniel Friday Martin in Yale Town.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya secures a seat at the UN Security Council. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you offer advice to your siblings? If so, what kind of advice?
Yes, I advise my siblings. I tell them to be respectful to everybody, old and young alike.
Yes, I advise my siblings. I tell them not to waste money, but to be careful in the way they handle money. I also tell them to give to people who are in need.
Hard work always pays, and if you work hard, at the end, you realize something that you didn't expect. So that's the single piece of advice that I offer to my siblings.
I always tell them to they work hard in school. Then, of course, they should be open in case they want anything or lack anything.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Kenya has officially taken a seat as a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. This comes after Kenya beat Djibouti for the seat. Kenya joins 9 other non-permanent members, and as Morino Jambo reports, Kenya's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Martin Kimani, says Kenya will use its tenure to ensure the safety of all Africans.
Speaking in New York City on Monday, Kenya's representative in the United Nations Security Council on permanent seat, Ambassador Martin Kimani, said that Kenya will ensure Africa and other developing states are well represented in matters of security.
Kenya is honored for the third time to begin its tenure as an elected member of the Security Council. We are profoundly conscious of the urgency of this moment in working to strengthen a multilateralism that serves the interests of our people in the Council, thus being an effective guardian of durable peace. Our mission will be innovative and open to new ideas and approaches, especially in strengthening prevention and regionally anchored solutions. We will listen. We will speak up boldly for Africa.
Winning the seat for Kenya was not easy, given the stiff competition Kenya faced from Djibouti, despite an endorsement by the over 50 countries making up the African Union as the continent's choice for the position. Ambassador Kimani, however, said Kenya will work closely with all the African Union and the United Nations member states to ensure safety for all.
Kenya looks forward to working with the A3 plus one, namely Niger, Tunisia, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, to be a building block with the African Union and African people all over the world. To the people of Kenya, our mission in the Security Council will abide with our constitution. It will reflect your pragmatism, your dignity, and your ambition to build a fairer and more prosperous world. We will work daily to ensure that we live in a peaceful and secure region and in a global order that is respectful of our sovereignty.
Kenya won 129 votes against Djibouti's 62 votes in the last year's June voting, more than two-thirds the number required under the rules of procedure of the General Assembly to win the seat. On the other hand, Tunisia, which assumed presidency of the United Nations Security Council for the fourth time in its history, promised to strongly commit in ensuring peace and security. Ambassador Tarek Ladeb of Tunisia said that despite the ongoing conflict and instability across the world, they will ensure peace prevails.
We are fully aware that we are taking this responsibility in a delicate international context, marked by a number of pressing challenges, including the persistent coronavirus pandemic, the many ongoing open conflicts, and situations of violence and instability across the world. In this regard, we will spare no effort to promote consensus and unity in the Council in order to enhance its efficiency in discharging its main responsibilities in maintaining international peace and security.
Kenya joins 9 other non-permanent members and could get a chance to preside over the Council sittings, which is an opportunity to influence agenda. Kenya will now be part of key decision-making on global peace and security. Some of the decisions may include sanctions, authorizing use of force to preserve peace, and also electing judges of the International Court of Justice. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Ojiombo in Milwaukee, USA.
The head of the World Health Organization on Tuesday said he was, quote, disappointed that the Chinese officials had not finalized permission for the arrival of a team of experts into China to examine the origins of COVID-19.
I have once again made it clear that the mission is a priority for WHO and the international team. I have been assured that China is speeding up the internal procedure for the earliest possible deployment.
Still on COVID, there is a concern in South Africa's medical community that the COVID-19 vaccine currently available may not be fully effective against the variant recently identified in the country. As Darren Taylor reports in Johannesburg, South African scientists are already studying lineage of the new variant to fully determine the sort of risk it may present.
Scientists studying the variant of COVID-19 found in South Africa say so far they found no evidence that it causes more severe disease and higher death rates. However, says Professor Wolfgang Preiser, a virologist at Stellenbosch University, there's concern that the variant's more infectious.
The concerns as regards the South African strain and its transmissibility have yet to be fully substantiated, but of course, seeing our enormous resurgence over the past few weeks, which coincided with the rise of this new virus variant, makes one worry. And I can say that at this very moment, several research groups around the country are trying to find an answer whether it is true that it is more easily transmitted, and if so, how much worse it is.
Preiser shares the concern that the current vaccines won't work as well to combat the variant.
Those vaccines target the spike protein, which is the surface component of the virus. They basically mimic this and cause the body to form an immune response to that. Now, both variants, the UK one and ours, have changes in that spike protein. So, you know, it is right that one needs to worry whether these changes might influence the body's ability after vaccination to neutralize these viral variants.
Health authorities in the United Kingdom, which is currently battling its own COVID-19 variant, are of the opinion that the South African lineage is particularly dangerous. Preiser says it's too early to say this. He says South African scientists first need to study people who've recovered from the variant and those who've received vaccines in local trials to establish if the vaccines cause their bodies to recognize and thus combat the variant.
These things are happening at a very rapid pace, so I'm confident that over a few weeks we'll hopefully know whether that is indeed a worry. Personally, there's no reason to panic. I don't think we need to throw up our arms in despair and say the vaccine is not going to help us. We are not talking of a vaccine totally not working, but it might be that it is somewhat less efficacious against the South African variant than against the others.
If this is indeed the case, say scientists, it may be necessary to adapt the vaccines. Preiser says although that's very expensive, with the latest medical advances sparked by COVID-19, it's easier to do than it sounds.
Now, what we are having here are really innovative ways of making vaccines where you insert a piece of viral genome into either a carrier virus, which is harmless, or just in the form of messenger RNA into some innovative capsule, which then gets injected.
He says it doesn't take long to do this.
To tweak this genetic information shouldn't be a major process. That said, it's not a question of days or weeks. It's clearly a question of months. And of course, these new tweaked vaccines would also have to undergo certain forms of clinical trials to make sure they work and they are fine.
Many in South Africa say that's time that the country doesn't have, and its health sector simply can't handle flood after flood of patients severely ill with a new type of COVID-19. The country has yet to obtain any of the vaccines currently available, and it could be weeks before it concludes negotiations with manufacturers for supplies. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Britain entered another strict national lockdown Tuesday amid sudden and sharp resurgence in cases of COVID-19 linked to a new variant of the coronavirus. For VOA News, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain's elementary schools had only reopened for the new term Monday morning. By the evening, Prime Minister Boris Johnson had reversed course, announcing a third national lockdown.
The government is once again instructing you to stay at home.
So schools and universities are closed. Anne Longfield is Children's Commissioner for England.
It is something which will have a deep impact on children, a deep impact on their well-being and mental health.
The lockdown comes amid warnings that hospitals are being overwhelmed. The number of people hospitalised with COVID-19 is 40% higher than at the spring peak. Total deaths have risen above 75,000. The new variant of the coronavirus, identified in southern Britain in September, is up to 70% more infectious and is spreading across the country. Dr. Dominic Spray, Clinical Director of Adult Critical Care at St. George's Hospital in London.
We have people in their 40s, their 30s, their 20s on our intensive care unit dying of COVID. We are having to think about whether we do cancer surgery. We're having to postpone cancer surgery because of the number of COVID patients we have in.
Chloe Peach, a senior nurse at St. George's Hospital, says staff morale is suffering.
It's been one of the worst shifts of my entire life. Intense, I'm looking after many more sick patients than I normally look after. It's just overwhelming, the whole situation.
Once again, the government must respond to an escalating health emergency and a resurgent economic crisis as non-essential shops and services are forced to close. The government announced one-off grants of up to $12,200 for businesses, but hundreds of them have already closed for good. Gary Marshall is owner of Bevington Salads, which supplies the hospitality industry.
The lockdowns, the tier systems, etc., especially to the hospitality sector, have had a tremendous effect, an astronomical effect on the industry. It is really, really in a bad place.
But this time there is one big difference. Britain began mass vaccinations using the Oxford University AstraZeneca jab Monday. Already, 1 million people have received the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. The government aims to inoculate 2 million people every week from Monday. In his televised address, Prime Minister Johnson told the British public there is hope on the horizon.
If deaths start to fall as the vaccine takes effect, and critically, if everyone plays their part by following the rules, then I hope we can steadily move out of lockdown.
That could happen by March if the vaccinations go to plan. But the government warns the coming weeks will be the hardest yet since the pandemic began. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with Teresa Nyankor Matiang with the song Pin Junoop. We've been listening to Teresa Nyankor Matiang with the song Pin Junoop. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Kenwa jenu mo jen kogati.